You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And coming up later in our show, did God say, let there be guns? The NRA says so.
President Obama, who wants to redefine freedom, whittle away freedom, and infringe upon the freedoms that we the people reserve for ourselves. They're God-given freedoms. They belong to us.
God-given, okay. We will discuss that. And also, are we the people, the terrorists now? And in fact, let me just dive right into that. Hebshi Shoshana is an American citizen and the mother of 7-year-old twins. She's also one of the latest casualties of the hysteria built into our national war on terror. On the 10th anniversary of 9/11, she flew on Frontier Airlines to Detroit. When the plane pulled up to the gate, all the passengers on board were ordered to stay in their seats, put their heads down, and put their arms up in front of them. Federal agents carrying large military-style weapons then boarded the plane and marched down the aisles. And here's Shoshana talking about what happened to her next.
I wondered if there was a fugitive on board. I had no idea they were coming for me. When they stopped at my row and ordered me to stand up, I was completely shocked and panicked. I was ordered off the flight at gunpoint, handcuffed, shuttled into the back of a police car, into a small cell where an officer strip searched me. I was scared and alone in that dirty cell. I can't begin to describe the humiliation I felt. No one would tell me what was going on, despite my repeated requests for information. No one told me of my rights or when I would be able to call my family, who had no idea where I was.
After some time, Hebshi Shoshana was interrogated by an FBI agent, and she eventually learned that she had been removed from the plane because of her ethnic name, Hebshi, an Arabic name, and her seat assignment. She's half Jewish, half Arabic, by the way. She was seated between two men who were described by flight attendants as, quote, possibly of Arab descent. Oh, my God, three of them in a row. Those men had gone to the restroom a couple of times during the flight. These two men, by the way, were also American citizens, just like Hebshi, only she being Jewish and Middle Eastern, they were of Indian descent. But in our post-9/11 fear frenzy, whipped up by George W. Bush, the simple act of using the bathroom while being Arab-looking is enough to get you dragged off a plane at gunpoint. And under the Patriot Act, it's completely justifiable for federal agents armed to the teeth to spring into action and drag you, because of whoever is sitting next to you, off the plane, strip you naked, and put you in a jail cell indefinitely without a phone call, without the right to a lawyer, and without any information whatsoever about why you're being detained. And they can legally keep you there for the rest of your life. To repeat, all of this is now legal in post-George W. Bush America. All of this can happen to any of us, just as it happened to Hebshi Shoshana, the American citizen and middle-class, middle-aged mother of twin boys. She now lives in fear that this might happen to her again.
In my wildest dreams, I would have never imagined being in this situation. And I often think about what would have happened if my twin boys had been there with me. Every time I fly, I wonder if today is the day it's going to happen again. I wonder if I will leave the flight on my own accord or be paraded through the aisle like a criminal. I know now that my only crime on that day was having an ethnic name and an arbitrary seat assignment.
You know, it's kind of hard to imagine this happening to any of us, although I'm guessing that people who have grown up African-American in this country or Hispanic in this country probably can more easily imagine it than those of us who grew up white in this country. But increasingly, it's now all of us, as our national war on terror has been running on for more than a decade, and we've gone nationally crazy. I mean, with this war on terror, we've seen two full-fledged wars fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, killing hundreds of thousands of people, destroying the lives of millions at the cost of trillions of dollars. We've seen multiple covert drone wars launched in places like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. We've seen an enormous security state apparatus constructed here at home that collects our personal emails, our text messages, our phone conversations, and God only knows what else. We have watched the legalization of indefinite detention of American citizens. And frankly, the Constitution, by the way, doesn't differentiate. It says persons. Anybody on American soil should have access to the Bill of Rights. Well, not only have foreigners lost those rights, but you and I, if assuming you're a citizen, have as well. Lost our rights as citizens, and now we can be held without charges, without trial, without the ability to even confront our accusers if an authority says that they suspect us of affiliating with terrorist organizations. And in the case of Hebshi Shoshana, we've seen the ruthless counterterror operations that we believed were only done in far-off places like the Middle East or secret CIA detention facilities. We've seen all this stuff brought home and used against us, against American citizens, on American airliners. Not that brand, obviously. On airplanes in America, at American airports. And for the most part, we the people have let all this stuff happen. So now, as this war on terror turns inward and begins devouring us from within, we should be asking ourselves, what have we created? With the help of the ACLU, Hebshi Shoshana is filing suit against the FBI, Frontier Airlines, the TSA, ICE, and Customs and Border Protection. She hopes her lawsuit will bring, quote, accountability and changes so this type of thing doesn't happen again, end quote. We can only hope. But the fact is that we, the people, allowed this war on terror to begin and to grow. And if we, the people, don't put it to end, to rest fast, then it's going to be turning its guns on us, too. You know, all these right-wing gun nuts are running around saying, we got to have our guns take on the government. All right. And the rationalization that they use is Adolf Hitler took away the guns. Well, factually, it's inaccurate. But more important, it wasn't just Hitler who killed the gypsies and the Jews and the communists and the trade unionists and the gays and the Catholics. And then ultimately pretty much anybody who stood up against him in Germany. It wasn't just Hitler. It was the German people. Hitler was one of the most popular leaders ever. The German people as a whole. It was German people on Kristallnacht who went out and smashed windows. It was the German people who participated in these things. Like this national hysteria. Oh, look at, there are different people among us. Tell me that's not happening here now. I mean, obviously not on the scale, and I don't want to diminish the Holocaust in any way by the comparison, and I suppose at some level any comparison does, but there are lessons to be learned from watching countries that have gone insane, where fear has been whipped up in the media for the purposes of political gain. When are we going to start standing up and saying, you know, we're not afraid anymore? Can we bring that back to our country?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Is it possible that America could once again become the land of the free and the home of the brave? How does a nation, welcome back, by the way, 20 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. How does a nation become a terrorist state to its own citizens? How does a country begin frightening its own people? It always begins with fear. It always begins with fear. And usually it's a fear of other. It's a fear of different lifestyles, fear of different appearances, fear of different ethnicities, fear, you know, it's a fear of the other. There's this foundational thing. I'm convinced that there's actually a biological reason for this, that we are wired to be basically tribal, or familial at the very least. That we are wired as primates, and frankly, I think you see this probably in all mammals, to protect kith and kin, right? To watch out for those. Well, actually, we know some of the neurochemistry of this. Oxytocin, not the drug that Rush Limbaugh got addicted to, that was OxyContin. But oxytocin is a hormone that the body produces in response to a variety of things. It's associated with, it's massively spikes during childbirth. And it also seems to be associated with sexual arousal and with, quote, love, falling in love. And what it does is it actually binds people to each other. When people are in each other's presence and they both have high levels of oxytocin, there's a binding that goes on. You've probably seen or heard stories of or even seen video of, you know, the baby duck that got hatched with the geese. And the first goose that the first bird that the duck saw was a mother goose, and so, you know, thought, oh, mom, and follows them around. Or the dog that was raised by the cat, or the cat that was raised by the dog. Yeah, I mean, there's all these examples out there. And most of that tracks back to oxytocin, to this, you know, there's actually a chemical thing about us bonding to each other. So family is the tightest binding, the tightest bond. And there's an actual chemical, neurological, hormonal, oxytocin is a hormone, associated with that. Measurable, definable. And in fact, I would suggest it goes beyond immediate family. So then beyond family, of course, is extended family. Which historically, I mean, you know, cousins and nephews and nieces and second cousins and third cousins and fourth cousins. And historically, that's been called tribe. People who are relatively closely related. And Malcolm Gladwell, in his first book, Blink was his second. And the title of his first book had something to do with things going viral, as it were. But in any case, he quoted some really, really good research in there that showed that humans are wired to be able to bond with about 150 people, and that there's a difference between brain size and the ability to bond. And our brains, and you could track this on a scale, that you know, a mouse can bond with a certain number of other mice, a dog can bond with a certain number of dogs, you know, a chimpanzee can bond with a certain number of chimps, and all the way up to humans, you can just draw a line, and you can see that brain size is correlated with social group size. And our social group size is 150. That's how many we can feel bonded to at any one given moment in our lives. Now, some people have the ability to massively expand that number. I would say that's somebody like Bill Clinton, somebody who's just incredibly socially competent. And some people have, you know, probably a much smaller number than that 150. You know, people who are very more introverted and more, you know, keep to themselves. But this is biological stuff. And so when you combine that, you know, that fundamental biology with somebody saying, oh, look at them, they're different than you, they're different than us, it triggers something that's primal in us. And then when they add to that, oh, look at them, they're different than us, and they represent a threat to us, that triggers something that's even more deeply primal. Fight and flight, fight or flight, that fight or flight response that comes out of the limbic brain is something we don't just share with mammals. We share with lizards. All right, you frighten a snake and it will rear up and it will either fight or it will flee. You can see it making its calculations. We're talking about really fundamental stuff here, stuff that's way beyond the ability of our conscious mind to control because it's wired into us. It's wired into us at a level that's below words, below logic. And then you say, oh, look at, they're different than us. Now they're outside our group, our tribe, our family. They're different than us, and they represent a threat to us. And then you kick a third one in there. Oh, and not only that, they're inferior to us. And now, oh, well, they're not even fully human. And now you've set the stage for everything from 6,000 years of slavery in modern civilization to genocide, the destruction of the Native Americans, the Holocaust. So what's the message that's being conveyed by all this hysteria? All this, be afraid, be very afraid. I mean, this is powerful stuff. This is dynamite. Whether it was the Hutus and the Tutsis, or whether it was, you know, what happened in Europe before World War II, or whether it's what we've seen throughout civilization over and over and over again, the genocide against the Native Americans here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We need to listen very carefully when people say, be afraid, and ask ourselves, what are they really trying to accomplish? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. So, are we the people, the terrorists now? You know, history tells us that, well, frankly, this is something to be very, very concerned about. And it's not so much the government. Here's a little-known factoid that you can find it was actually an article in Der Spiegel magazine in 2003. In 1937, the Nazi Party was firmly in control of Germany. The SS was the basically their secret police service, and it had 7,000 people. This is for a country of 60 million, 7,000 people. Just East Berlin had over 100,000 secret police. The Nazis didn't need that large a police force. Why? Because the people were enthusiastically policing themselves. There were radio stations all across Germany in the 1930s. A regular piece of radio shows was call in and report a suspicious neighbor. And people would call in and they'd report suspicious people on the air. The equivalent of what they did on that airplane when somebody said to the flight attendant, hey, that guy who looks like he's Arab sitting in seat B12 and the other one over in A12 and that woman next to them, they all have dark skin and the two guys went to the bathroom twice. Paul in Pennington Gap, Virginia. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today? I love your show.
Thank you.
Paul. I'm a gun owner, and, you know, I believe in the clip size, downsizing to the 10-round clip. But I believe that if that's the case, then the police should go down to a 10-round clip. Everybody should go to a 10-round clip. I also keep getting this image in my head of the Occupy protesters who were handcuffed and then sprayed with the pepper spray in their face. If the government is going to regulate these types of weapons, how are people going to end up defending themselves against FBI intrusion, coming into your house unwarranted? If the police are the only ones that are having guns, like the Egyptians and the Libyans and all, you're going to see people throwing rocks and bottles. How do you defend against that?
Well, how did the Egyptians defend against that?
Well,
they had it a lot worse than you and I do.
They were protesting for democracy. They had no weapons. They were peacefully protesting.
That's right.
And they were surrounded by officers with AK-47s.
Right.
People getting shot.
So, Paul, think about this for a minute. I mean, just consider this. The Egyptians stood there peacefully and said, if you're going to shoot into the crowd, we will continue to stand here. You know, the Egyptian police killed a couple hundred people. Hosni Mubarak was convicted of that, of ordering, you know, the murder of several hundred people in the crowd. And the people never pulled out a gun. In Syria, the people shot back. And so far, 60,000 people are dead and the war is still going on. Which one was successful?
I would expect to be able to defend myself if the police were shooting at me for peacefully protesting.
Well, if you're defending yourself with a gun, you're not peacefully protesting. You're engaging in civil war.
Protect yourself.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Well, like I said, you know, I can't get that vision out of my head of occupiers with their handcuffs.
Well, that's my point, Paul. That's such a powerful vision of those people, and people of an older generation can't get out of their heads the pictures of Martin Luther King and all the civil rights marchers standing there in Selma as the dogs were turned on them and the fire hoses literally knocking them down off the street, and as they were being beaten with billy clubs, and they just stood there or fell to the ground bleeding. But they did not pull out a MAC-10 and drop 10 clips into the nearest cop. They did not. And who won that? Who won that battle?
Well, they won. The people won. But
exactly.
The thing is,
because of nonviolence.
With all the ways that they can get into your lives now, you know, and you have no way to protect.
You know, they were doing that back then. But they were we just in the last couple of years, the FBI has, under Freedom of Information Act requests, has been forced to release some of their tape recordings and notes of, you know, where they were wiretapping the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and, you know, some of his infidelities and difficulties and whatnot. And it's, you know, it's kind of embarrassing stuff. But, you know, we're all human beings here. But the point is that, you know, they've been doing that forever. But again, has. You know, who won? Martin Luther King Jr. won, ultimately. And he won. And now, just play that movie again in your head and imagine that in Selma there are those African-Americans standing there on that street or on the Pettus Bridge. They're standing there and the dogs are turned on them and the fire hoses are turned on them. And they whip out a bunch of AR-15s, a bunch of Bushmasters, and start spraying bullets at the police. How do you think that would end?
Well, the same thing happened in Louisiana and Katrina. Those people got killed out on the bridge by the police trying to flee.
It was black people who got killed by white cops.
Well, I mean, that's not the point. They still were killed by the police.
Right, so again, let me ask you, Paul, if those people who were trying to flee who got killed by the police, which is, I think, a poor example because, you know, that was a small group in an isolated instance, and it wasn't a protest. You're talking about protesting. You're talking about taking on, you know, speaking truth to power, standing up to the government, standing up to power. So I think, you know, the more appropriate example is the Occupy protesters and Martin Luther King. If the civil rights protesters had pulled out a Bushmaster and started mowing down cops, if those Occupy protesters, as the police were trying to put handcuffs on them, had reached into their back pockets and pulled out a Sig Sauer and you know, emptied a nine shot clip into the police around them, what would have happened? Serious question.
Well, I believe there would have been chaos.
There would have been chaos. They would be in jail for the rest of their lives. You and I would not be thinking of them as heroes. We'd be thinking of them as criminals. I mean, how do we think of David Koresh?
Well, I would think that the police would be considered criminals for shooting into an unarmed group of people.
Well, if they were unarmed, again, at Kent State, you had those protesters and the police, you know, there was the order to fire. The police fired. Four kids were killed. Had those kids at Kent State been marching with rifles and had they fired at the police even after the National Guard, even after the National Guard fired at them, how would we remember them? Would we remember them as martyrs? Would we remember them? Would that have been the turning point to the end of the Vietnam War? I don't think so.
Well, I'm a Vietnam veteran, but I got something that really kind of irks me, too, is that I bought a gun recently. I'm a gun owner, and I bought a 38, five shots 38. Now, in Virginia, here where I live, when you buy the gun, if you buy it from a legitimate dealer, you have to register it. They run the background checks.
Right.
Now, I bought this gun off of a private owner, which I didn't have to have any paperwork at all on, just to buy the gun. I tried to have the gun registered to me, and the state wouldn't register the gun to me.
Yeah, well, that's a problem, and I think all of our state laws are dysfunctional. But have we reached some kind of an agreement that if you arm protesters, they're no longer protesters?
Well, it's not about, I'm not saying I'm the protesters. I'm saying that the people should have a right to be able to protect themselves against that type of governmental intrusion.
Against criminals. But I'll tell you, I don't think that that there has ever been a time in history when the people protected themselves successfully against their own government using weapons. Now, maybe I'm missing something, but it's you know, why did we intervene in Sarajevo? Remember that during the Clinton administration? We intervened because people who had no weapons were in that city, and they were being starved by an army that had surrounded it and was lobbing shells into there and indiscriminately killing people. Had those people not been unarmed, had they not been basically peaceful, we would not have gone in. We wouldn't have sent the UN in. We wouldn't have gotten all the NATO countries together. I mean, those people took on Bosnians or Serbs, I forget who was who and what, you know, what the details of that were, but basically, you know, that was what stirred the outrage of the world, was that these are unarmed families who are not shooting back, or, you know, occasionally they try, but I mean they're hopelessly outgunned, but they're basically not shooting back, and that's why we came to their defense. The Occupy protesters, they were not, you know, spraying pepper gas back at the police. And that's why we came to their defense, and they have our sympathy. The civil rights protesters.
All the erosions of the Bill of Rights that we have under and the constitutional rights that they're taking away from us, I just happen to feel the need to have to protect yourself.
I think that the need to protect yourself from criminals is probably wise. Whether you do it with a gun or martial arts or just, you know, the way you configure your home or whatever. But to protect yourself from your government, the most powerful way you can do that, Paul, is to become the government, is to run for political office, is to participate with in a political party, is to change the laws. If you don't like the fact that the Patriot Act is on the books, then start lobbying against it. But if you start lobbying, to mangle a pun, hand grenades, or if you start throwing bullets, you're going to lose. And your cause is going to be hurt. I'm telling you, people who think that they can fight back against a tyrannical government with weapons, they're not even going to be seen as martyrs. They're going to go down in history as the David Koreshes, as the you know, maybe a small fringe will think of them as martyrs, but most people will not. Most people will think of them as, you know, that crazy guy with all those guns. Paul, thank you for the call. Thank you for the thoughtful conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. How best do we once again become the land of the free and the home of the brave? 10 minutes before the hour, talk media for the sane among us. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora.
Yes, I was just going to point out a perfect example of when our government did round up people. That was during World War II, and the Japanese did it peacefully. They went peacefully when the government told them, you have to live in these camps. And they did not take up arms against the government.
That's right. And it didn't work out so well over the short term. You know, in other words, they ended up in the concentration camps, and they lost pretty much all of their property.
Right.
But had they tried to shoot back,
They would have been dead.
Yeah, they would have just been wiped out. That would have been, this is proof. And, you know, sometimes, which is not that I'm saying, hey, you know, if the government comes and says we're going to put you in a concentration camp, you should go along. But we should all be vigilant. And, you know, I would say that in our day, the equivalent of the Japanese being put in the concentration camp on a much smaller scale is this woman, Hebshi Shoshana, who was, you know, dragged off this airplane and stripped naked in a jail cell. And
yes, because she's imprisoned in her own way.
That's right. And you know, I mean, she ultimately got out, but she's now imprisoned by post-traumatic stress disorder. And these are, you know, these are things that we fight not with guns, not with weapons, but with knowledge, with information, and with political action.
And just recently we had the death of Daniel Inouye, who got out of the camps and fought for his country.
And became a United States Senator.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. Cora, thank you for the call. Thank you for the discourse. Shirley in Fromberg, Montana, says, you disagree with me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here's my idea. Give everybody, I don't care who it is, give them a gun. Let all the people kill whoever they want to kill. And then Wayne LaPierre can be king, which he wants to be, of all the gun-toting crazies, and run his own little country.
Yeah. I assume you're being tongue-in-cheek, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. But ironically, Shirley, what you are prescribing is exactly what Wayne LaPierre is prescribing. You know, he said the only way you can stop a bad guy with a gun is to be a good guy with a gun. And I think, frankly, he's wrong. I think historically, you know, when the bad guys have had the guns, it has, you know, and good guys have tried to take them on with guns, it hasn't worked out as well as when good guys took them on peacefully and nonviolently or using politics. So thank you very much, Shirley. I appreciate the call. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Just I'd like to encourage you and your listeners to, on Google, any search engine you want, just search on unconstitutional official acts. And the very first thing that will come up is a thing on American jurisprudence. And it just reiterates that it says either the Constitution prevails. It says a law is constitutional or it's not. It says any statute to be valid must be in agreement with the Constitution. It says it's impossible for both the Constitution and a law violating it to be valid. One
right.
must prevail.
Right. So and I would encourage people.
All the provisions you're talking about in the Patriot Act, they're unconstitutional. But what's more interesting is it says, no one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. But last but not least, the most important part. I'd really encourage you to read the excerpt. It's excellent. But it says, all citizens and legal residents of the United States by their presence on the territory of the United States are subject to the duty, militia duty, the duty of the social compact that creates a society, which requires that each alone and in concert with others not only obey the Constitution and constitutional official acts, but help enforce them, if necessary, at the risk of one's life.
Okay, you can't obey.
We have a duty to stand up and say, we will not obey these statutes.
Yeah. Bill, I'd be careful of anybody who says you should obey the Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't direct us to do anything. What it does is it limits the power of our government, which is us. But that's the Constitution is a bill of negative rights, to quote Barack Obama in the 2008 campaign. It limits the power of the government. And I don't disagree that it is, you know, the courts should not be enforcing unconstitutional laws. However, at least under the contemporary interpretation of the Constitution, as filtered through the Marbury versus Madison 1803 decision, the Supreme Court's decision of what the Constitution says is what the Constitution says. And so far, most of the Patriot Act, according to them, is constitutional. Whether it's constitutional or not, and I think, frankly, if you simply read the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th amendments of the Constitution, you will get what's wrong with the Patriot Act immediately. I mean, it's a simple language. It's layman's language. But beyond that, if we want to do something about that, we have to engage in political action. We have to participate in the political process rather than just, you know, saying, hey, I'm going to go get five more guns.
Why are we not standing up in mass and basically demanding impeachment of the Supreme Court? I mean,
I think we stood up in mass.
You know,
we stood up in mass about 3 months ago. It was an election. 100 million of us showed up. A third of the country showed up. Now, it's tragic. It was only a third, but a third of the country showed up and said, yeah, I have an opinion.
You and I will agree to disagree that our elections any longer provide representative government.
I will agree with you that to a frightening extent they do not, and that we need to do something about that. But I would submit that if they fully did not, Mitt Romney would be president right now.
Yeah, but to do something about it is not to hold another election. You and I have disagreed many times on this, that we do this to the electoral process. It's not working. They own and control everything. It'll be the lesser of two evils, but it'll still be evil.
It's a cliche, Bill.
By voting in the right
guy. It's a cliche. You want the better of two perfects?
No, I don't want the better of two perfects, but I want somebody that's representing me instead of going into office day one saying I'm going to spend the bulk of my time attempting to gain lobbyist funds for re-election.
Do you think Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown and Jan Schakowsky don't represent their districts?
They do represent their districts, but they're going to make some pretty unhealthy compromises, or they're going to be ineffectual, and they're going to be thrown out of office after one term.
Bernie has been in office for two decades. You know, he was reelected more times to the House of Representatives than any independent politician in the history of the United States.
And how many times has he stood up on the floor and said these acts that you're proposing are unconstitutional?
Over and over and over again.
Criminals.
I don't know about the criminals part, but over and over and over again, Bernie Sanders speaks out. In fact, I got an email this morning. I'm on his email list. You know, if you go over to sanders.senate.gov, you can sign up for his newsletter. And I just got one this morning talking about how he's saying we need the talking filibuster. We need to stand up to this Republican thuggery. My phrase, not his. But, you know, we need the talking filibuster. I think there are still some good representatives, and I think that if enough of us engage ourselves in the political process, Bill, there can be more. And that's what it's going to take. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mark Walters is on the line. He is the host of Armed American Radio, nationally syndicated, the author of Lessons from Armed America, and a concealed carry expert. The website is armedamericanradio.com. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your audience.
Thanks for joining us. So outside of the obvious deer hunting or a weapon to protect yourself in your home, your vehicle, or, you know, walking around outside, and the target shooting, why would we have to have a gun?
Personal defense, but I mean...
I named that.
Well, you've just pretty much covered the reasons we would need a gun.
So
they're fun to shoot on top of everything else, and they're used by millions of law-abiding citizens responsibly every day.
I agree. I'm a sports shooter myself.
Right.
So that said, what do you say to the people among who call themselves gun advocates who say that they need guns in case the government turns tyrannical?
You know, listen, the Second Amendment, first of all, isn't about duck hunting or hunting. It was written many, many years ago. The Bill of Rights was ratified 1791, 222 years ago, last month, actually, December 15th. And we have to remember that the founding fathers had just fought what they believed to be a tyrannical government and overthrew what they believed to be a tyrannical government to gain their freedom. Things change. There's no question about that. We have to get past, I think, the divisiveness.
Wait a second. Are you saying that the Second Amendment was written so that we could overthrow our own government?
No, I said it was written. I believe that the Second Amendment was written to keep a tyrannical government in check, and I would submit that
I would ask you to provide me with any evidence of that whatsoever. I've read most of the ratifying convention debates on the Second Amendment, and repeatedly there's reference to self-defense. There's reference to a militia that can protect the free state or the nation. James Madison, his second draft said a free country. He changed that to a free state in the third draft of the Second Amendment to satisfy the people from, you know, basically Patrick Henry and George Mason, who were concerned that their state militias, which were also their slave patrols, might get disarmed by the federal government because of the Article I, Section 8 powers that the federal government took to arm militia. And, you know, if they chose not to arm, then the state wouldn't have the power to arm. But nowhere did I see any reference to overthrowing the government that they had just created.
No, I don't think they were referring to overthrowing the government that they had just created. And what people need to understand is that the Second Amendment exists in this country. It is ratified. And if we're going to have a discussion moving forward, we have to understand where we are today and what we're going to do to stop some of the violence.
But it wasn't put there to stop a tyrannical government. I would submit that there were two primary purposes for the Second Amendment as it stands. The first was to prevent us from ever having a standing army. And there's, you know, ample evidence of that. I mean, that was written at that time, at the time of ratification. That was the standing armies are an impediment to freedom and various languages are the same. Was written into the Constitution of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania. I mean, a number of states had already literally written that into their constitutions, saying that there would not be standing armies. The first draft of the Second Amendment said standing armies during times of peace. I forget the phrase, but, you know, were antithetical to a free people. They did not, you know, because the founders, they had seen, you know, they knew the history of Europe over and over and over again. Countries had been taken over by military coup, and they did not want. And that's why the only appropriation that Congress can make in the entire Constitution that is limited. Congress can establish Social Security to last forever. They can establish welfare programs to last forever. They can establish, telephone systems, whatever they want, except for the Army. Appropriations for the Army have to be revisited every 2 years, or they zero out. And the reason was because most of the founders didn't want us to have an army. They wanted us to be like Switzerland and have a militia that was controlled at the state level. And so that was the first reason. And the second reason was that the southern states in Georgia, California, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, the state militias were also slave patrols. They you know, toured the countryside looking for runaway slaves and inspected slave quarters periodically. And they had to be armed to do that. You had in eastern Virginia or western Virginia, you had a 10-to-1 ratio of African Americans to white people. And the white people were living in fear of their slaves revolting, and the armed militia, you know, put that down. So, but none of that, you know, is about putting down our own government. All of that is about protecting our government.
I'm not sure who's talking about putting down our government. I'm certainly not. And to get into a debate,
well, you said, you know, the Second Amendment was to stop a tyrannical government, and I'm saying it wasn't. It was to protect us against. Well, if you want to say when Canada invaded us in the War of 1812, they were tyrannical. Is that what you mean?
No, sir. What I was saying was that the founders had just fought a tyrannical government. The Second Amendment is in existence to keep a government, to keep us from a tyrannical government. We can debate this all day long. The fact of the matter is that the Second Amendment exists, and there are a lot of people in this country who don't like the Second Amendment. And what I submit to you is that we have got to go forward. We can go back and refight history all we want.
Okay, let's go forward. The Second Amendment says in order to have a well-regulated militia, that be necessary to the security of a free state, the right of individuals to I'm doing this from memory, so I'm sure I've got a couple words wrong here, but the right of individuals to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thank you. Where do we sign up for the militia? I propose that we rename the National Guard, because every state has one. There's the Michigan National Guard, whatever state you're in, Mark, there's a National Guard there, that we rename those the National Militia.
Okay.
And so if you are a member of the National Militia, you have an absolute 100% certifiable right to a weapon.
And we don't. Are we talking about, are we going to have a collective or individual rights argument here? Is that where we're at?
Well, no, I'm talking, you said, let's go, we have the Second Amendment. It's written the way it's written. Let's go forward. And so I'm saying, okay, fine. It's written.
Let's go forward and get past the semantics. We have 300+ million firearms in the hands of over 100+ million private individuals today, and that is not going to change.
Yeah, it's not over 100 million individuals.
That's not going to change.
It's not over 100 million individuals. It's
okay. Whatever your statistics.
It's about 1 in 8, not 1 in 3.
Okay. All right. Well, whatever number you want to throw at it, the fact of the matter is we have hundreds of millions of firearms.
Yes.
In the hands of millions. Let's make it millions.
Okay. Well, I have a solution for that.
What's that?
You know, when we figured out that doctors could kill people, we said we are going to register doctors, we're going to license them, make sure that they're proficient, and we're going to regulate them. When we discovered that cars could kill people in the 1920s and 1930s, we said, okay, you're going to register your car, you have to have liability insurance. Oh, and doctors also have to have liability insurance, and you have to prove proficiency. You have to have a driver's license. Why not do the same thing with weapons? They can kill people. So let's register them just like you register a car. Let's have liability insurance for the weapon and for the owner, and have proof of proficiency. I've been through the Georgia Police Academy. I can demonstrate my proficiency with a weapon. I'm guessing that you can too.
Let's, I certainly can, yeah.
Let's say, and you know, sure, you have a right to a gun, but that, you know, you also have a right to free speech, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. There is no such thing as an unlimited right.
I don't have a problem, quite frankly. I think it would shock you and surprise you to understand that, well, I think you and I agree on more things than we disagree on, and that is keeping firearms out of the hands of bad people who shouldn't have firearms.
And children.
And children. Listen, I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. I'm not going to argue with that. As a responsible gun owner, I have a very large, what I refer to as a gorilla safe in my home where my firearms are kept.
Good on you.
I also have what's referred to as a gun vault. You've probably seen
yep.
one with the fingertips on it that gives me instant access should I need it for self-defense in the dead of the night. But my firearms are kept away from children and anybody else that I don't want to have
yeah.
them.
So would you go along with my let's treat firearms like we treat cars?
No, I wouldn't go along with that. I wouldn't at all. It is a constitutional right to keep and bear arms, and it's not.
We have a constitutional right to roads. It's in Article 1, Section 8.
Are we going to a break?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
Okay.
Mark, in fact, thank you very much for being with it, Mark. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to have the last word on you.
That's okay. That's quite all right. I understand the time frame.
We will continue this conversation another time. We will live to fight another day, as they say. ArmedAmericanRadio.com. Hang on just a second, Mark.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That guy always steps on me. Thank you, Mark. Mark Walters, thank you very much for being with us.
No problem. Thanks, Brad.
Okay. Great talking with you. We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 8:30 tonight, I'll be on Current TV with John Fugelsang on his show, The Viewpoint. Just as a quick FYI, should be entertaining. Say what? Okay, got it right. 8:30 Eastern time, of course. Yeah. So, let me get this right. A God-given right to own a weapon. Let me just deconstruct that for a moment. We have a God-given right to... Now, when did God give us this right? I mean, people who argue the Second Amendment, they're arguing that the government created a right to bear arms, that our government specifically created that right and essentially gave it to us or guaranteed it to us. Or you could say that they're arguing that the Second Amendment prevents the government from taking that God-given right away from us. But then that raises the question, when did God say thou shalt have a right to own guns? I'm not sure. But ask Wayne LaPierre. Here he is.
President Obama, who wants to redefine freedom, whittle away freedom, and infringe upon the freedoms that we the people reserve for ourselves. They're God-given freedoms. They belong to us in the United
really?
States of America as our birthright. No government gave them to us.
The Second Amendment?
And no government can ever take them away.
Right. Okay. So President Obama wants to redefine freedom. I must have been out of town or asleep. I missed that part of the inaugural speech. Maybe I dozed off. I know that the president said that our programs like Social Security don't make us a nation of takers, and that they give us, maybe he said, the freedom to step off and, you know, do entrepreneurial things, the things that make this country great. But wants to redefine freedom. I think that Pierre LaPierre was talking about that. Here, clip number one, Shane. Keep in mind, before you hear this, keep in mind, the people who wrote the Constitution, and then 2 years later, the people who wrote the Bill of Rights, and there's a lot of overlap. In fact, James Madison was probably 80% of all of both of them. But nonetheless, those people were very, very clear that they were making the transition from 13 independent nation states that were tied together by what was basically a trade agreement. The Articles of Confederation provided for no national army, provided for no federal powers, basically. And just basically a system to resolve disputes between the states that mostly had to do with trade. And it wasn't working. This new country that we had birthed as people think that we went right from the Revolutionary War into the Constitution. Wrong. We went from the Revolutionary War into operating under the Articles of Confederation. It was our first constitution, our first, you know, the first document by which we all, the 13 colonies, were operating. And it wasn't working. And so these guys got together, and literally they were guys, they got together and said, let's create a stronger central government. Let's create a Supreme Court, which will be the ultimate court. Let's create a president who will be the commander-in-chief of all, both the national military and the militias of all the states. It's right there in Article 1, Section 8. Read it. Let's create a national government that will build roads and establish a post office. Let's create a national government that will provide for the general welfare of the people. Yes, it's there twice in the Constitution. Let's do that. Let's make it a we society, not a me society. And President Obama, at least five times in his inaugural address, talked about we the people, the first three words of the Constitution. And I thought it was one of the most brilliant speeches in recent time that clearly identified the intent of the founders and framers. Founders being the people who signed the Declaration of Independence and fought the war, the framers being the people who framed the Constitution. But Wayne LaPierre, not so much.
Yesterday, in his second inaugural address, President Barack Obama quoted the Declaration of Independence, and he talked about unalienable rights. I would argue that his words make a mockery of both.
And I would argue, sir, that you are off your rocker. Wayne LaPierre is not here to defend himself, so I'm not going to. We'll just consider what he has to say. Clip number two.
Obama wants to turn the idea of absolutism into a dirty word, just another word for extremism. It's a way of redefining words so that common sense is turned upside down and that nobody knows the difference.
Really? How is taking an absolute position, saying there's no gray area, there is no in between, the right to free speech includes the right to yell fire in a crowded theater. The right to free speech includes the right to, as the talk radio host did famously in Rwanda, start screaming, go out and kill the other people. Kill the Hutus or Tutsis. I got to Google that and get which one's right, because I've referred to it three or four times in the last couple of weeks, and I don't remember which was which, but whichever. See, Wayne LaPierre is fine with us having a check and balance, as it were, a gray area, a restraint on the right of free speech. I haven't heard him screaming about how he wants the right to yell fire in a crowded theater, but the right to own a weapon, when that Second Amendment has the word regulated in it?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think if he is complaining that he's being called an extremist, he's an extremist. We'll be back. Yeah, the tip of the hat, and many thanks to Bruce with KBCS, 91.3 in Seattle, who says it was the Hutus chasing the Tutsis. And I get, you know, for me, the way to remember that, if you can make an absurd picture in your mind, well, actually, I shouldn't share with you my absurd picture. You can come up with your own. Mine's pretty absurd. So, but in any case, the Hutus chasing the Tutsis. But the point is that it was talk radio. It was a talk radio show that said to the Hutus, get out there and defend yourself against the Tutsis. They're coming to get you. And again, this is what I was talking about earlier about, you know, this is the limbic brain stuff, the fight or flight stuff. When you first of all say they're different than us, and then you say they're inferior to us, and then you say, and they're coming to get us, and then you say, go get them first, what you end up with is mayhem. It ain't a good thing. Lawrence in Arlington, Texas. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Tom, I caught the last part of your conversation about guns, so you're just the right person for me to ask. I think I can get an honest, you know, critique of the situation from you. Let me throw this at you. Black man, 55 years old, been buying guns for over 30 years, blue collar, General Motors-oriented background, you know, new to Texas, from Michigan, kids been brought up around guns, everybody I know in the guns. Here's the million-dollar question that I know I want you to give me a good critique. If I can't trust the federal government to hold them thugs in Wall Street accountable who bankrupt the country, and Obama never sent none of them to prison, if I can't trust the federal government, Obama, to speak on 180 kids under the age of 18 killed by guns in Chicago, over 500, and I'm from Flint, Michigan, home of the sit-downers, blue-collar all the way, and there's so much death and destruction happening in Flint, Michigan every week, and Detroit. If I can't trust this black president who I voted and supported twice, knocked on doors, if I find him going on TV saying the worst day of his presidency when them 20 little white kids was killed by that evil scoundrel up there in Connecticut, that evil dog.
Lawrence, what's the punchline here?
The punchline is this. Why the hell should I trust Obama when he talk about we should have all our guns registered? He's being disingenuous. Don't you think he's being more than a little disingenuous when he say he cares about children?
Why do you... Okay, I get it that you got some complaints about President Obama. Why do you think that registering your gun is a threat to you?
I don't want the federal... That's my whole point. I can't trust the federal government. The federal government don't have my best interest at heart. Why should I let them know, or why would I want them to know what I own, when I buy it, where I buy it from? Why would I want them to know that?
Is your car registered, Lawrence?
Huh?
Is your car registered?
Yeah, the car is registered.
Okay, you know why it's registered?
I'll put it like this. The car is, if we're going to equate that, I know where you're going, and I'm not even going to argue that point. My point is this.
No. I don't think you know why you have to register your car. Because, you know, is your computer registered with the government?
Get off of it. I'm going to put it like this. They want you to register your car because in each state you live in, it's different requirements and it's different amounts of money that you pay for your registration of your car. So that guy from the NRA, he might have had something there. Two reasons. They wanted to, just like in Georgia, and we lived over 2 years
in Georgia. Tax it or take it is what Wayne LaPierre said. And I don't think he's wrong. I think that if you're going to have, you know, the reason why you have to register your car is in case it is stolen or used in a crime, it can be identified. Because a car is something that's capable of killing people. Now, once you set up a bureaucracy that is necessary to register something like a car, there's costs associated with that. And that's why when you register your car, you have to pay 20, 30 bucks a year, 50 bucks a year, whatever it is, depending on the state you're in. That fee is supposed to capture the cost of maintaining that registry and of tracking down people who've stolen your car. And there's a good case to be made for gun owners to be out there saying, we think that there should be a national registry. So if my gun is stolen, I can report it as stolen. So if it's used in a crime, I'm not going to be the one that they come back on.
Can I say something to that effect? In Michigan, where I was born, I come from Flint, Michigan. When I was first started buying my guns in the 70s, I had to go down, register. They checked me. I had to buy it. Then I had to take it to the police station where they fingerprint me, register my gun, give
this
me my
green
card.
For a carry conceal permit.
No. We had to register all our firearms in Michigan back in the day. They gave us a green card, and it was kept on file at the police department to get your gun permit, and I got one way.
Now, I grew up in Michigan, and my brother owns a bunch of guns, and I've been in gun shows. I've been in gun stores. I've seen people buy and sell guns. I've never seen anything like that. In fact, the last time I saw a gun transaction happen in the state of Michigan was just 3 years ago.
And I think they quit.
And there was no government involvement in any of it.
No, I haven't lived in Michigan. We left Michigan, a couple months ago because we went to Kansas, been living in Georgia. General Motors just shot us all the way around the country. But here's the point. Guns don't kill people. It's the person pulling the trigger.
A dog only knows what you teach it. A child only knows what you teach it. You can't blame the dog, blame the owner. You can't blame the kid, blame the parent. You can't blame the gun, blame the person that's pulling the trigger. That connection right there, that nexus, don't you agree with that, Tom?
No, I think that that is terribly simplistic logic. Guns, for the 20,000 people a year in the United States who commit suicide using guns, I would submit to you that probably two-thirds of those people wouldn't have committed suicide if they didn't have something that was easily at hand that they knew would instantly end their life in what they consider to be a painless way. I would submit to you that for the 10,000 people in the United States who are killed with guns, that the reason why we have a gun-based homicide rate that's 30 times that of any other developed nation in the world, and well over total homicide rate that's well over 8 times that of any other developed nation in the world, is because there are so many weapons around. When you've got some, guns are designed to kill people. You could say, you know, but guns don't kill people. People kill people. Nonsense. Guns kill people. That's what they're designed for. Are you trying to tell me that the people at Remington and the people at the other gun manufacturers and the people, for all I know, you're calling on behalf of, that those people are not designing things saying, how can we most effectively make this kill people? You think the people who are designing cop killer ammunition, the wad cutter bullets, this will pierce even the best Teflon bulletproof vests. The people who are putting together the 50 caliber weapons that'll pierce the side of a tank. You think that they're not thinking that this is a device designed to kill people?
I agree.
Are you trying to tell me that seriously?
Nope. I agree with everything you said.
Okay.
Everything you said is true, and that's the whole point. My point is simply this: the society that we live in, this government that we live in, that we're part of, is run by big business. And everything you said is true, and only a fool would sit up there and
say, what does that have to do with guns, Lawrence?
My point is this. If we are the largest producer, this country, of firearms, we'd have armed every country in the world. Every country in the world buys arms from us. Like you said, all the weapons that you name, we sell them all over the world. Over in Iraq right now, it's all right.
What's your point, Lawrence?
To have a machine gun in it. If a household in Iraq, where we send our men and women to die, protect, if they can have a machine gun in their house, you mean to tell me we going to talk about registering our guns when we send our sons and daughters to fight in other countries and we ain't trying to disarm them other countries? Why are we trying to disarm?
Let me ask you a question, Lawrence. Are you suggesting that the reason that you need to have guns is because you think that someday you may have to fight the United States government?
Nope. I got guns for two reasons. For two reasons. I like the sport, and number two is to protect myself from thugs.
Then why are you going off on Iraq and Iraqis and Afghans?
Because my point is, that's hypocritical on us. We going to disarm and regulate our guns, and then we going to sell guns to every country in the world.
First of all, who's talking about disarming Americans? I have not heard that conversation. What did I miss? When did that happen?
Tom, now come on now. I'm 55. I haven't lived my life in a bottle. I stay abreast, I read, I participate in the political process, and I don't belong to the NRA, and I'm a liberal.
Please tell me, who is calling for the disarmament of Americans? One name.
I believe President Obama? I'm gonna tell you,
when did he say that? On what day?
No, I said this is his intent. I'm saying,
how do you know what his intent is? Do you read minds?
I'm looking at the man's track record.
How long have you been able to know what other people think, Lawrence? Is this something that an ability you were born with, or is this something you've acquired recently?
I would say this. I say I'm just like you.
I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know what President Obama is thinking. You have the ability to know what he's thinking. I'm astounded by that. And you know that he's thinking he wants to disarm America. How did you get that ability? Is this did you take a hallucinogen?
No, hold it. I'm not a soothsayer. I'm not a palm reader. I'm not a psychic.
Okay. Are you on drugs?
Hell no.
Okay. How do you read other people's minds?
I go by a person's actions.
And when did Mr. Obama disarm anybody?
No, I say that he's attempting to enact.
When did he attempt to disarm anybody?
I figured this is what this whole gun control and registration is all about. Why would you want to know what I
So you're imagining that he, you know, I'm the president has not even calling for nationwide registration of guns, contrary to what Wayne LaPierre said. All he's calling for is nationwide background checks before you buy a gun. That's it. I'm the one who's calling for national registration of guns. Because I think that responsible gun owners want, just like responsible car owners want, if their guns or their vehicles are stolen, they want to be able to say, ain't mine. Lawrence, thank you for the call. And, boy, when you figure out how to tell other people, how to teach other people how to read minds, let me know.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, he watches Psych, the TV show. He learned it from the two guys on Psych. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service here to find out what's going on in the world. TalkRadioNews.com, of course, their website, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. That's at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line. Hey, Ellen, I have a question for you.
Go for it.
This is one of my callers called in and asked this question. He said, you know, Wayne LaPierre is asserting that we have a right to have guns, right? That it's a constitutional right. And we have established, for example, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, you have a right to an attorney if you're charged with a crime. And because
but
you have a right to it.
Before that. Given a well-regulated militia.
Well, hang on just a second. You have a right to an attorney, and because you have a right to it, if you can't afford an attorney, the state will give one to you. You have a right to an education in the United States, and if you can't afford to go to a private school, the state will pay for your school. So if you have a right to a gun, where do I sign up to get my free government-issued gun?
Ha! Good point.
Yeah, I thought so. So anyhow, what's going on in the world?
As long as it doesn't have more than 10 bullets in the magazine.
There you go.
So the former First Lady Senator and now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testified before the Senate today. John McCain said that her description of the events was unsatisfactory. And it's interesting that Rand Paul said that if he was president during the crisis, he would have fired her on the grounds of failure of leadership. She stated basically that there have been a couple of studies that have been done and by Congress and others, and that in both of those, it was said that the request for more help at this embassy was below her level. She said, obviously, they're going to take steps to correct it. At one point, she said to Rand Paul, I believe, listen, we have 4 dead Americans. What difference does it make in terms of whether they went out for a protest or these bad guys took a walk at night and tried to kill Americans?
Right. She said
the other
Ron
thing
Johnson.
I did not know that came out is that when the Marines cover an embassy, it is to protect the papers and not the people. It is embassy security that protects the people.
Oh, and the embassy security is hired from Blackwater type groups, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and some embassy staff, et cetera, and of course also the State Department has its own security.
Because the two people who were killed, the two security guys who were killed, were not.
That's right.
They were not Marines.
Employed directly.
Right. They were ex. One of them was an ex contractor, and one was ex military, as I recall.
Right.
But
did
she not also point out?
She also said that basically she said there is this assertion about her Sunday afternoon talking points and whether this was a protest or coordinated terrorist attack, and basically she said, you know, look, these guys are not good people, and she takes responsibility for it. I mean, she really did fend them off pretty good today.
Yeah.
Also, Ron Johnson, the Republican from Wisconsin, said that he believed that Susan Rice intentionally misled things. Now, the political side of this is very interesting. Marco Rubio, who, you know, had told everybody basically he was going to come out swinging, was very subdued. He must have decided that this would not make good tape to play when he decides to run for president.
Against her.
Yes.
I think they're trying to draw blood in advance of that, you know, knock her off her game.
Okay.
Did she not also point out, by the way, that
today, first of all, the Pentagon has decided to lift the ban on combat roles for women. Our own Jolene Espinoza, when she was a U-2 pilot, they did decide on that particular plane to lift that. It was considered a combat job, and it's been done sort of piecemeal, but not altogether. However, over the last year, in May of last year, they took 14,335 positions, and previously had barred women, and now women are allowed to serve on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. House today passed to suspend the debt limit for 4 months. The vote was 285 to 144. It's really interesting. 33 Republicans voted against the bills. 111 Democrats voted against it. And, of course, the White House said that the debt limit must be raised. Unclear why those all 111 did, and they're not for the same reason. Also, they have till May 19th to pass the budget. If they don't so at that time, lawmakers are going to lose their congressional pay. But, of course, what's interesting about that is that may violate the 27th Amendment, saying that you cannot have a change in congressional pay except in the next session, in other words, the next 2 years. So the question is does this violate that piece of the Constitution? Interesting.
Yes, it is. It is. And
okay. Also, the White House said that the White House is glad that the Republicans are not exhibiting brinkmanship with regards to the debt ceiling, and that he said the president wanted a more long-term solution, but at least this was something. Mm-hmm. Now, we have an interesting situation with Mr. Boehner, the Speaker of the House. On one hand, he yesterday, or was pretty conciliatory, actually, yesterday around the president. He said that, you know, basically he's sort of realizing they can't infuriate all the minorities in this country, particularly Hispanics. I think they're still willing to alienate gays. But he said there's the government runs out of money on March 27th. We don't know what's going to happen. Then on the other hand, to the Ripon Society, which was essentially a closed to press, but they did release a transcript and I think video of this today, and that's how we have this information. He basically said that the president's goal is to annihilate the Republican Party. He said he's the guy that's run up the deficit 60% and went on and on.
Can you spell projection?
I'm sorry?
Projection. You know, assuming that others are
that
doing what you're up to.
That old psychological thing, exactly. Yeah. Ooh, Tom, I love talking to you. Some other interesting factoids today. It looks like the unionized workforce went down just a little bit. The 14.4 million people, 11.3% of the U.S. workforce, down from 11.8%. 35% of federal, state, municipal employees are members of unions. The unionization rate in New York is the highest at 23.2%. North Carolina has the lowest at 2.9%.
Ellen, we're out of time. Ellen Renner, thank you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, serious question here. And, you know, we can continue talking about, you know, what's going on in the federal government or the Republicans or the Democrats or the gun control or Blaine Lapierre or whatever you want. But I heard on a radio program this morning, I heard a whole show segment about how the federal government, specifically, I believe, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is preparing to really crack down on doctors who are prescribing opiates. Now, you know, as a talk show host and a person who's, you know, working in the industry that was basically founded by Rush Limbaugh, I feel that all of us talk show hosts have a certain duty to defend opiates. And to the best of my knowledge, and I'm not making this up, to the best of my knowledge, the main side effect of long-term use of opiates, outside of constipation, I guess that's one of the other side effects, but the main side effect of long-term use of opiates is addiction. And this was what the FDA said they were so concerned about, and so they're going to start cracking down on people who are taking opiates for pain, Vicodin, oxycodone, OxyContin, whatever. I don't know all the names of them. Dilaudid, Demerol. There's a whole long list. But anyhow, they're going to start cracking down on these doctors that are passing out these pain pills and on the patients who are using them. And there's a lot of people, millions of people apparently, who are in chronic pain in the United States who are quite freaked out because the opiates keep the chronic pain at bay. And the FDA is saying, is preparing to say, we only want these kinds of drugs, these drugs that have addiction potential, to be prescribed for people who are about to die, who are experiencing end-stage cancer levels of pain. And plus, they're going to die, so it doesn't matter if they're addicted anyway. I'm addicted to food. I mean, it's and water. It's even worse than an addiction because if I go more than a month or so without food, more than a week or so without water, I don't just go through withdrawal. I die. I'm confused about this. There is a study, a new Swedish study came out from Lund University. It's published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. That says that if you drink, now this is an epidemiological study, they did an analysis of this, if you drink one can of soda pop every day, and you're a man, your risk of prostate cancer goes up 40%. They even identified one of the chemicals, it's called 4-methylimidazole, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. It is, you know, the label on the can says caramel coloring. It's a known animal carcinogen, according to an article by Scott Phil on Alternet today. The headlines say it ain't so. A can of soda a day can increase the risk of cancer for men by 40%. Now, I could be wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, being addicted to opiates doesn't cause cancer. That maybe there's some other incredible downside. But I'm wondering why are we going after narcotic drugs and we're not going after carcinogens? Could it be that the soda industry is like one of the most powerful forces on earth? And the pharmaceutical industry knows that, you know, there's real pain and real people with real pain, and it's not going to be too big a bite out of their butts if they lose a few customers. It just seems to me like a classic case. You know, which is more dangerous, Pepsi or Coke, as in cocaine? Cocaine is actually a Schedule II drug. Actually, you extend this logic even further, which is more dangerous, Coke or marijuana? According to the federal government, marijuana. It's a Schedule I drug, which means that there's no medicinal value whatsoever. Cocaine is a Schedule II, which means that there's medicinal value. They actually use it in surgery and things. It's a local anesthetic, I believe. But I think back, you know, heroin was a cough syrup that was manufactured by Bayer, as they say it in Germany, where the company is based, or Bayer, we call it in the United States. It was heroin brand cough syrup for children. In the 19-teens, they came out with it. You can find pictures on the internets of the original bottle with a nice little label and the ads that ran in the magazines. The child has the cough. Buy heroin cough syrup. Heroin brand cough syrup. Lydia Pinkham's tonic was a big deal in the 1700s, the 1800s in the United States. It contained opium. And women all across America chugged this stuff down every day for their entire lives. grew to old age and died. Coca-Cola. Why do you think it was called Coca-Cola? It had cocaine in it. And, you know, for 150, 200 years, well, 150 years more or less, our country got along just fine without any of this drug hysteria. And at the same time that, you know, the illegal drugs and, or, you know, clamping down on narcotics. And at the same time, we increasingly took the position that it is actually the role of the government to protect people from predatory companies that would sell them products that cause cancer or death or harm. Whether it was contaminated food, it was originally called the Pure Food and Drug Administration. Whether it was contaminated food or whether it was, you know, phony baloney drugs, things that didn't help us. So, if the major side effect, and I say this as somebody who was once an addict. I smoked cigarettes from the time I was 13 until I was 21 years old. I know addiction. It's no fun. But, hey, we say cigarettes are illegal. And they are five times more addictive than heroin. Go back and look at the studies. Look at the studies are based on what's called chipping behavior. Chipping behavior is where you occasionally use a drug and you don't get addicted to it. And the fewer the number of people who can chip something, the more addictive it is. So the number of people who chip pot, very high. A lot of people use it occasionally and never, you know, get it. Very few people get addicted or habituated or whatever to pot. Cocaine, it's a little harder. It's easier to get addicted or habituated. Methamphetamine, it gets even worse. And we're giving that to our kids. Opiate drugs, a little harder. More frequently, people become addicted if they chip it, if they use it occasionally with some frequency. Nicotine, five times more people. Five times, 500% fewer people can chip nicotine than any other drug. So, and then on top of that, we got soda pop that causes prostate cancer. The caramel coloring in cola beverages causing prostate cancer. It's like, where are our priorities? So, just, you know, a little digression there. I don't know if this is a topic that you would have an opinion on or any experience with, and I would be in particular interested to hear from anybody who knows of any side effects to long-term use of narcotics and opiates other than addiction and constipation. But it seems to me like, you know, we're just spending too much time in the wrong places.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Not that I'm calling for, you know, decriminalizing these things. I think it's entirely appropriate that we regulate these drugs, and I think that we should be regulating cigarettes too. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Jim in Gresham, Oregon. Hey, Jim.
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking about opiates and that. Sounds like the FDA is going to crack down once again on opiates for people in chronic pain. Mm-hmm. I have a condition called arachnoiditis. Most people don't know what that is, but it's a very painful nerve disease. And statistically, 80% of the people that have this are incapable of working. My use of opiates allows me to work. Mm-hmm. But to take it a step further, work is essential to my mental health, my mental well-being. If they were to restrict my use of opiates to control the pain, then that puts me in a very depressed state.
Yeah.
Not being able to do something, not being able to be productive is very, very depressing.
Well, I'll tell you, my experience with this, you know, I had surgery in August and then my surgery went bad and my doctor was on vacation and I ended up back in the hospital in the ER, you know, not nearly dead, but I was heading in that direction and ended up having, you know, another procedure and all. And I was a wreck. And for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that, I was taking Dilaudid every day, which is a pretty potent opiate-based narcotic, I believe. And my experience of that was that it allowed me to function. I didn't experience getting high on that until toward the very end of my taking it. I noticed, and by that time I was just taking it at night to get through, you know, to sleep. I noticed that I was getting high, and that's when I pretty much ran out and quit. And then, you know, and by that time the surgery pain was pretty much, it wasn't gone, but I mean, it was pretty much largely gone away. And I have heard it said that if you have genuine pain, you don't actually get addicted to narcotics. They basically, the pain sucks up the drugs. Has that been your experience, or do you feel that you're addicted, and do you get high from those drugs?
I don't experience a high. I haven't. I've been taking them for over 20 years. My condition is a forever condition.
Yeah.
I get side effects, what I call side effects, but I don't get that effect that the drug seekers get. Right. I don't experience a high.
Yeah.
Side effects I get are pretty negative. I wouldn't consider that a high.
Yeah.
And I do just take it for pain. Also, I give myself a chance to come down off them until I can't stand it anymore. So I break that constant intake up a little bit. That seems to help.
Yeah, that seems.
And there are other tricks that I use to control the pain. It's just not narcotics. But
yeah.
Without the narcotics, I would be a mess.
Yeah. Okay, Jim. Thanks for weighing in, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Kip in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. Hey, Kip. You wanted to comment
on
addiction?
How are you? Finally talking with the Tomster.
I guess.
I've been calling quite a few times, and I admire your knowledge. I really do. I've read a few of your books, and...
Well, thank you. You wanted to comment on addiction?
Yes, I did. I am a 61-year-old, I guess what you would call a tipper. You know,
an occasional user of a potentially addictive drug.
User of an opioid drug. I've had two spinal fusions, and I have had a knee replacement.
Ouch.
So I've dealt a lot with a lot of pain since 1986.
Right.
I never knew anything about pain pills and those kind of things until I had that first surgery.
Right.
Then I learned that if you have a drink with the pain pill, it makes it even less pain, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, a lot of these pain pills have acetaminophen in it, and you have a drink with Tylenol, and you don't have a liver anymore. It's the leading cause of liver failure in the United States is Tylenol, is acetaminophen. Not that brand name Tylenol, but the generic drug. And they mix it with these opiates so that you can't, so that if you do take a lot to get high, to try and get high, for example, that you will damage your liver, which seems to me really a stupid way to do, you know, to discourage people from using opiates. But, Kip, thanks for sharing your story. I appreciate it. Laura in Park Ridge, Illinois, you disagree about legalizing pot. I didn't call for legalizing pot. I called for decriminalizing it, but.
Well, I have a lot of issues, to talk about, but
sure.
I want to first say that, I think I appreciate the fact that you clarified that indeed the issue of long-term use of benzos is certainly going to give people an issue with their liver. I just sat in a workshop on my addictions unit where, you know, we said to the patients, you know, absolutely you cannot be mixing these drugs with alcohol because you're going to lose your liver.
Yep.
And
especially acetaminophen.
Well, and the fact that alcohol is the most widely abused drug, it is the worst drug for your body. It attacks every single organ in the body. But I think where the...
And it's highly addictive. And it's highly addictive.
Well, yeah, and I think what the disservice you do your listeners is the fact that the people who have issues with opiates are the ones who have issues with addiction. These are people who are already predisposed to being addicts.
Mm-hmm.
They go.
But
in
here's my question, Laura. What's wrong with being an addict?
What's wrong with being an addict?
Right.
Well, you talk to someone who continuously comes in a hospital. They can't hold a job. They can't have relationships.
Okay. Are you talking about people who are experiencing those because the drug to which they are addicted is illegal or unavailable to them? Because I know a lot of people who are addicted to nicotine, and which is cheap, and they are not dysfunctional. But if nicotine had to be bought in the black market and it cost them $100 to get it and they had to rob a bank periodically to get it, they'd probably be showing up in the addiction units.
But I will say that on the scale, on the continuum of drugs that are going to cause people to have issues with relationships and jobs, nicotine is probably far on the least likely to cause those problems. Do I agree with you that nicotine is a drug and should be banned? Yeah, I see absolutely no reason that it should be on the market.
Laura, I wish I could hang on to you longer. It's the tyranny of the clock. The bottom of the hour is coming up. And we'll have to continue the conversation later. Thank you very much, though, for bringing a thoughtful perspective to it. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So if soft drinks increase the risk of prostate cancer by 40%, and narcotics don't, which is worse for you? That's the good, the bad, and the very, very retratously ugly, the good. Academic partnerships. Academic Partnerships, a company that helps public universities put their courses online, has partnered with three university systems to put free, four-credit courses online. Arizona State University, the University of Cincinnati, and the University of Arkansas will become the first schools in the nation to offer free online classes that come with credits to the respective institutions. This new program is a particularly big deal for this nation's undocumented immigrants who want to get an education but can't do so legally. Let's hope more universities decide to join the program and offer top-notch education for free to millions of Americans. The bad. Senator John McCain. At a bipartisan press conference yesterday, McCain was asked about the upcoming hearings over the appointment of Senator John Kerry as Secretary of State. McCain responded with a joke, but people today aren't laughing. McCain told a reporter, quote, "We will look forward to interrogating him at his hearing next week mercilessly. We will bring him back for the only time, waterboarding to get the truth out of him." Right. The use of torture by American forces on our enemies is far from a laughing matter, and these incredibly offensive and ignorant comments are particularly surprising coming in from a man who suffered firsthand the pain and suffering that torture causes. And the very, very ugly, Paul Clement and House Republicans. Clement is the attorney that House Republicans paid over $3 million in taxpayer money to defend the Anti-Gay Defense of Marriage Act. Yesterday, a brief that Clement wrote for the Supreme Court was released to the public. On behalf of Republicans, Clement argues that, quote, "In short, gays and lesbians are one of the most influential, best-connected, best-funded, and best-organized interest groups in modern politics and have attained more legislative victories, political power, and popular favor in less time than virtually any other group in American history. Given that the ultimate inquiry focuses on whether a group needs the special intervention of the courts or whether issues should be left for the democratic process, the political strength of gays and lesbians in the political process should be outcome determinative here." End quote. Essentially, Clement and Republicans are arguing that gay people are too powerful to have equal rights. Apparently, both Clement and House Republicans are unaware of the near constant discrimination that the LGBT community faces each and every day, from the workplace to local restaurants to houses of worship. And that is very, very ugly. Okay. Welcome back. We're, you know, it's an interesting conversation here about addiction and how do we, you know, what do we regulate? Should we be regulating soda pop, which, according to this new study out of Finland, says that increases the risk of prostate cancer 40%. It was a study just done on men. They, you know, we don't know what it's doing to women. And, or should we be cracking, you know, is the FDA right to be cracking down on opiates? David in Springfield, Missouri, you have a list of bad effects for narcotic drugs.
Hi, Tom. The marijuana, there may be 200 peer-reviewed studies, but if they were done in this country, they were done illegally because it's against federal law to study a class one drug. Anyway, you'll hear my goat. So I've got to get him.
Yeah, I do. David, it is not against the law to do longitudinal studies, studies over time of populations who have used illegal drugs. And
sort of a prospective study in giving patients class one drug.
Sure.
You can't get that done. But I've had some friends who started using marijuana in childhood, and 20 years later, after daily use, some of them look pretty dopey. I think people are, you know, some people can tolerate a lot of it, and some people can't. And addictions are like that too. I mean, some people, one drink of alcohol and they're gone for weeks,
right?
Whereas other people have to work a lot harder at it.
But aren't I don't disagree with you at all. And I've known people that back in the 60s were potheads and today still are potheads now in their 50s and 60s. And some of them are pretty dopey and some of them are actually, you know, one of them is a prosecuting attorney for a major area. I mean, some of them are quite functional. Here's the question. Shouldn't this be dealt with as a medical issue rather than a criminal issue?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All these drugs ought to be legal. But what happens is that people have different resistance to these drugs. And,
sure.
And one of the biggest problems with the memory loss is the drug's effect on REM sleep. And some people can take drugs and it just, you know, they lose their memory in a few months.
Right.
And other people seem to do very well for years.
Like, yeah, because REM sleep, which is dreaming sleep, this is the time when the hippocampus, the scratch pad of the brain that only has a one-day memory, it basically writes down everything that happens to you all day long. And then during the night, I mean, the most recent science seems to indicate that during the night, dreaming is where the rest of the brain takes all of the stuff that happened to us during the day, processes it, trying to make sense out of it, and decides what to keep and what to throw away and stores it. And that's when long-term memory is established. But the drugs that do the most damage to long-term memory because they screw up REM sleep are not narcotics or pot. It's sleeping pills.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Tranquilizers and antihistamines and some of the new seizure drugs.
Well, in particular, the benzodiazepine drugs and I forget the name of the drugs that, in fact, I'm now forgetting. It must be happening to me. The name of that drug that one of the people on, it's a very popular sleeping pill. Ambien, that's right. I've never used it, so I can't remember the name. I'm not all that familiar with it. But I understand that drug will knock people out of, prevents REM sleep as well. I'm just, speculating. But I know that with sleeping pills.
But if you don't delete redundant files, your brain really does clog up with a bunch of unnecessary stuff.
David, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Bill, in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Bill, you work in social services?
Yes, sir, I do. I actually work for child services here in the state. One of the things you haven't mentioned, and I think it's important, is the issue of the family that are involved with this situation, in opiates.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of children that we get in custody in the county I work in were born opiate addicted. It's called drug exposed child infant.
Right.
We get a huge amount of children in that are born addicted to opiates. And the families are the ones that usually, the parents go out and they break in, and it happens, breaks into gas, into grocery stores, pharmacies, homes just to get pills.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge impact on the family structure and children who are born addicted to these drugs. Now, obviously, you don't bring into a store into a house to get cigarettes.
Yeah. Well, so, and fetal alcohol syndrome is a major problem. And in fact, when Louise and I ran the New England Salem Children's Village, I was surprised by the number of children in the system who have fetal alcohol syndrome in varying degrees. Mom was an alcoholic and the child is born, with their mental processes compromised, among other things. I mean, there are actual physical symptoms as well. But doesn't all of that argue for better, for a national medical service, universal health care? And
I agree totally with that.
Okay. So
I think the FDA, if I'm thinking what they are going to do correctly, there are legitimate uses for medications of that kind for pain.
Sure.
The pill mills are probably what they're aiming for, the pill mills, if I had to guess.
Right. And the pill mills are basically just passing pills out to people who are using them to get high. But my understanding of the way narcotics work is that if you're using them to get high, that only works for a short while. I mean, that's how it was with me with nicotine. I mean, the first few weeks you notice, hey, wow. After that, when it's actual addiction, you just crave it when it's gone. You don't get high when you're using it.
And that's why the people are breaking into homes and hospitals and stores to get the opiates. I think that in this area anyway, pills have overtaken meth and other forms of drugs.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed in my travels is that in Great Britain, you can walk into a pharmacy and buy, and the way I learned this actually was eating in an Indian restaurant in London about 15 years ago and getting the most god-awful case of diarrhea I ever had in my life. And I went into the pharmacy around the corner from my hotel the next morning, actually it was 2 days later, and described my problem to the pharmacist. And they said, here, take this, and gave me this Lydia Pinkham. No, it wasn't Lydia Pinkham. It was Hollis Brown or something like Collis Brown. It was some Dr. Brown's tonic, right? And I drank that stuff, and boom, it immediately worked. And then I read the label, and it's morphine.
Well,
and it's like, I just bought morphine over the counter.
Well, I don't think that's as prominent now here as it is in Britain in the 90s. But
yeah,
I'm all for I totally support national health care, but I also support a database and a way to keep less than reputable doctors from simply writing a script for somebody who walks in and for 500 pills and they're gone in 2 days.
Yeah.
That's the issue we're having. I think that's
And that's what we saw played out with Rush Limbaugh, where he was literally taking so much of this stuff that it would have killed a normal person, and it did kill off his ears. And, you know, we would like to avoid that, I think, happening to anybody else. Phil, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be back with more of your calls and thoughts on this topic and others we've been discussing today, although I find this fascinating. 45 minutes past the hour. Should we be regulating soda pop if it causes cancer as aggressively as we regulate drugs that cause addiction?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Addict, or at least addicted to something that doesn't have killing you built into it, like alcohol. Isn't it better to be an addict than to be dead from cancer? Welcome back, Tom Harmon here with you, and Becky in Alberta, Canada. Hey, Becky, thank you for listening and on our website.
Hi, how are you? I've been listening to you for years. Finally get to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you. You are a nurse?
Yes, I'm a nurse. I'm working up here in Alberta. Before then, I was working for the VA hospital in the state, you know, miracle of dual citizenship.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I wanted to mention about the issue on opiates.
Mm-hmm.
I've given a lot of morphine in my life, particularly with hospice patients, but also with patients with very hard to treat extreme pain
mm-hmm.
for pain management.
Right.
And though I dangerous to things like morphine, toxicity can be deadly. If you have a diminished kidney function, you have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a CNS depressant, and so if you take it with at home and you're drinking, that can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually not a bad pain med.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about it is, despite what almost everybody thinks, technically it's not addictive.
Now, you know, in Afghanistan, and it used to be in China, it was quite common to smoke opium, which is, you know, morphine is a super refined and
right.
potentized form of opium. It's been processed to it's slightly molecularly different, but basically opium is the core of all this stuff. Are you suggesting that opium is also not addictive, that these people are smoking opium?
No, I do not know about opium.
Okay.
I just know about
so how is morphine not addictive?
Because by definition, an addiction requires both a physical and a psychological element.
Uh-huh.
Opiates have they cause physical dependency.
Right.
Physical dependency is actually, by definition, not the same as addiction. If somebody is, like, this is taking morphine for pain that finally gets treated and he doesn't need it anymore, if he stops cold turkey, he's going to suffer big time. But to get off the morphine, it's pretty simple. If he wants to, he can do it easy. You do a step-down program.
Yeah,
you just diminish the amount, and diminish the any length into time, and you step it down until you don't need to take it anymore.
Right.
Unlike things like alcohol, and definitely unlike cigarettes, which are extremely addictive because of the psychological component.
Hmm.
So morphine and opiates of that nature cause physical dependency, and it's not the same as addiction.
Interesting. Unless the person has a psychological association or addiction to the feeling. I mean, could it be that there's an addiction-prone personality, and that kind of person, if narcotics are what's in their world, they'll get addicted to them, or alcohol.
If you want to get off it, you can. Some people have other issues going on.
Right. And the question that I keep asking that I haven't heard anybody give what in my mind is a definitive answer to is, what's wrong with being an addict as long as the thing you're addicted to is not killing you? I understand, the downside of nicotine addiction, although I'm not sure that there's actually a downside to nicotine addiction. I understand the downside to tobacco addiction. And I understand the downside to alcohol addiction, because alcohol destroys pretty much everything in your body. But I don't understand the downside to opiate addiction, because my understanding is that opiates basically don't produce very much damage to the body with long-term use.
Yes, I agree with you. There's nothing wrong with it. I know people who, because of this severe chronic pain, the morphine keeps them functional. They're taking, because it develops also physical tolerance, they're taking levels that would kill you or I.
Right.
And they go to work every day and they do very fine with it.
Yeah, I have a friend in Germany who was in a horrible...
It stops the severe pain and it keeps him going, and there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, I have a friend in Germany who was in a horrible car accident 15, 20 years ago, and he has been using, narcotic drugs all this time to keep the pain. He's highly functional, seems totally normal, but until you look at the pill bottle and say, whoa. But it's not killing him. Now, if he was using alcohol to deal with that pain, he would probably be dead by now.
I agree with you. It is actually one of the better pain management drugs.
Yeah. Okay. Becky, thank you very much for the call and for the information. I appreciate it. Jeff in Midvale, Utah. Hey, Jeff.
Hey. I just wanted to call in and say I use painkillers for some severe back pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have a friend who is addicted to soda pop, and I don't mean that lightly.
Yeah. No,
I think soda pop wouldn't be a bad thing to regulate.
I have a friend who literally drinks a case of soda pop every single day. I mean, a 12-pack case, and is really, really struggling with weight and health issues, and has been for years and years, and has been drinking this stuff for years and years. And I wonder if there's an association between the two. You know, the high fructose corn syrup, the chemicals, the caffeine, the addiction. But again, we're not, maybe we should be treating this as a public health issue, too, and telling more people about that. So, thank you very much for the call, Jeff. Fred in Lacey, Washington. Fred, we got a minute to the end of the show. It's yours.
Hi, Tom. I suffer from acute arthritis, significant arthritis throughout my body, but specifically in my neck and spine. And I'm also aspirin intolerant, and the way I found out I was aspirin intolerant is I was taking aspirin on a daily basis, recommended by my doctor, and it was stopping in my colon, in the diverticula.
Yeah, yeah, so you got diverticulitis. So now you're taking an opiate?
And so I all of the other drugs, prescriptions, et cetera, for arthritis are on the aspirin side of things, and so I take codeine daily. I take 4 pills a day, I function greatly.
Right, and codeine is a milder form of drug derived from opium, milder than morphine. Okay, very interesting. Fred, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening there in Lacey, Washington. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, we'll have the latest on what's happening in Congress and how it affects you, the fate of the filibuster, will they or won't they extend the debt ceiling, and more. Plus, are atheists out to undermine religion as we know it? What? I'll challenge Pastor and conservative rocker Bradley Dean. And my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science, along with the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.